This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. As the war in Iraq grinds on, Americans have become familiar with cities named Fallujah, Ramadi, Haditha. They are the sites of battles fought and ongoing. They are the battle cries of the Sunni insurgency and the war-weary Iraqi public. To Americans, they are both a test of attitudes about the fighting and a reminder of the most complicated moral calculations of war. Haditha seems destined to leave a particularly deep stain on the consciousness of Americans and the American military. When the story first surfaced, it seemed all too familiar. In November 2005, a Marine convoy was attacked by a roadside bomb while on patrol in Haditha. A popular young Marine was eviscerated in the attack. In the next several hours, 24 Iraqi civilians, including elderly men and women and children, were also killed. But how and why remains a matter of both grave dispute and criminal investigation. Journalist William Longavisha has reported extensively from Iraq since 2003, and he set out to unravel the mystery of Haditha. His new article, appearing in the November issue of Vanity Fair, doesn't claim to verify exactly what happened on that day, but he has come to some important conclusions about why it happened. His conclusions offer insights into what Americans can expect in Iraq in the future if the current strategy is maintained. Later in the hour, we'll talk to former anti-terror czar Richard Clark. He says it's time for the 9/11 blame game to stop. But first, William Longavisha. We'd particularly like to hear from our listeners with a military background. If you have experience in counterinsurgency, or if you have questions about how U.S. forces are fighting the insurgency in Iraq, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. William Longavisha joins us today from the studios of member station KXJZ in Sacramento. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in talking about this program, I have been using the term allegedly, that 24 unarmed civilians were allegedly massacred in Haditha. But is that really necessary? Is there any doubt that this happened?
I think it depends on how you use the term massacre. There's no doubt that 24 were killed. And beyond that, there's a lot of doubt. What I think massacre brings with it the implication of a crime having been committed. And I certainly, having looked at this extensively, do not know and do not pretend to know whether crimes were committed. I think the courts, the military courts, will decide that. It's not up to me to decide that. And I think it's really, at this point, not even knowable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So can you tell us what we do know about what happened that day? Other than that, we know that these civilians were killed. What else do we know that we can say?
I think the important thing to understand is that the Marines who were in Haditha and set up a base in Haditha were operating with a set of rules of engagement which were very standard for Iraq and are standard for a counterinsurgency campaign, which defined legitimate killing according to a fairly broad standard. Not only can you legitimize the killing of an obvious enemy, a guy carrying a gun who's shooting at you, you can also legitimately kill people who are running away from you, who happened unfortunately to get in the way either of your rifles or your grenades, or for that matter your bombs and missiles. This is the nature of the war that we're fighting in Iraq, and it's in fact, again, a question of if you want to assign blame. I'm not blaming the military for this. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine how we would go about fighting this war without such rules of engagement, because the underlying fact, far deeper than the rules of engagement, the basic truth that was operational there on that Haditha street, is that we cannot tell the difference between friend and foe. We don't have the ability to do that. People are not – the enemy is not wearing – uniform, and we don't speak the language. Our Marines in this case, soldiers in general, operate in really extreme isolation from Iraqi culture and the Iraqi street, even though they're definitely on the streets. I think that it is practically impossible to penetrate that isolation, and this is what the unfolding war in Iraq, I mean, the spiraling war in Iraq is showing that we, you know, this is not a question of stupidity. It's not a question of arrogance. It's not, certainly not a question of just brutality. It is a fundamental inability to deal with a foreign, popular, highly popular, I should say, insurrection.
We may be going far afield from where you went in your article, but Americans have been there before, haven't we? I mean, haven't Americans fought before in situations where they had difficulty determining friend from foe? They didn't know the culture. They didn't know the language. And having gone through conflicts like that before, did any of the lessons of previous conflicts like that inform our military strategy and tactics in Iraq?
Well, I was not in Vietnam. I'm a little bit younger than that. But from what I understand, the U.S. military came out of the experience of losing that war with very similar frustrations. In Vietnam, determined not to get involved in such a war again, and they turned in other directions for training specifically. And it's really the problem the military faces is they don't choose the wars they're sent into. So they find themselves again in a very similar situation. I mean, it is in some ways quite different from Vietnam, and in other ways it's eerily the same. I was talking to a Vietnam veteran recently who told me a little story about going off to Vietnam, and someone instructed him. He was in the military in the army. Someone instructed him about how to identify the enemy, and this man said to him, presumably an officer, "Well, look for guys when you're driving the roads of Vietnam. Look for guys in black pajamas." And this man, my friend, responded, "Well, okay. And does that mean that our friends or the non-combatants wear white pajamas?" Of course, they don't.
Let's go to a caller. Let's go to Miami, Florida, and Frank. Hello, Frank. Frank, I'm afraid we're having trouble hearing you, that if you can get to a clearer line, please feel free to call us back. We're going to keep going with William Longavisha. One of the most disturbing things I found about the peace bill, which is, it's just, you know, marvelously, you know, well-written and full of evocative detail, and I think a great sort of sense of compassion and dispassion at the same time, which is, I think, something we've come to expect from your work. But you say that the story of Haditha is about more than the fate of just a few men, the loss of their friend, or the casualties they inflicted along the Euphrates River one cool November morning. More fully explored, it is about the observable realities of an expanding guerrilla war, about mistakes that have been made, and regrettably, about the inability to fix what is wrong. Those limitations appear to be inherent in the military, and though they certainly have much to do with the reactions and resentments of the least competent soldiers, they also, in a different way, apply to the very best. And you seem to be saying that Haditha is an example of a course that has been set that is unlikely to change, is not changing, and that is inherently doomed to fail.
That is correct. Now, you can look at the military. I mean, one of the really amazing things about the U.S. military is how many very intelligent people are involved and capable of self-criticism, of learning lessons, of changes. As you probably know, today in the New York Times, there's a piece about the new counterinsurgency doctrine that's being formed and is coming out for both Marines and the Army. And this is a very intelligent piece of work. There's no question. They are identifying the very problems that I write about in Rules of Engagement. And these thinkers within the military are coming up with responses to it. The unfortunate thing is that ultimately, the tool itself, that is a large conventional armed force, is very difficult to apply no matter how smart you are, no matter how flexible, no matter how you change your rules of engagement. It's very difficult to apply to a foreign insurgency, to suppressing a foreign insurgency. Now, there are ways, no doubt, that if the United States wants to fight such a war, that it can perhaps be won. But I think that the lessons of Haditha and of Iraq are that, and should be that, we should not use the wrong tool. Now, it is really not the military's fault. They don't have the option of saying, "No, we're not going." They don't have the option of saying, "Send the State Department instead or something else." They say, "Yes, sir, and we will do the best job we can." And that is a very admirable and necessary attitude. But ultimately, if the wrong tool is chosen through political naivete or for whatever reason, there's very little that the military can do to reform itself, to make itself into the right tool. Now,
But tell me what you mean by the wrong tool, if you will, because, you know, if I've had the benefit of reading the article, and I'm sure many people will not have had the chance to do that. But so what do you mean by the wrong tool? I mean, we think of our military as the best equipped, the best trained, certainly technologically in the world. And frankly, from a standpoint of morality, we think our soldiers are extremely well versed in appropriate means of warfare. So by the wrong tool, what are you saying?
A heavy force applied to a non-traditional enemy. It's sort of like trying to go after terrorism with tanks. It's not that the tanks aren't good tanks, and it's certainly not that the people who are driving the tanks are in any way inadequate. It just doesn't work. It's the wrong tool. Obviously, there are areas within the military, like the special forces, which might be the right tool. I mean, it's not that the military does not contain this possibility, but we haven't seen that applied in Iraq. And if you talk about just Iraq, it's, of course, far too late for that at this stage. At an early stage, maybe there were things that could have been done by the military within the terms of the military. But at this stage, no amount of reform, laudable reform and deep thinking that is going on in self-criticism within the military, no amount of it is really going to fix the problem.
Why? Because the course has been set and is now, or is it that the consequences of mistakes are now so great that they can't be undone simply by a change in tactics?
We really can't react in Iraq with our military without inflicting casualties on non-combatants. Less than that, even inflicting insult on non-combatants.
Mr. Longavisha, this is such an important point. I want to be sure we hear you in your entirety on this point. We need to take a short break. We're talking with William Longavisha about his article on Haditha and the story behind the alleged atrocities that took place there. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. We're talking about Haditha, the Iraqi city where U.S. Marines allegedly killed 24 unarmed Iraqis. Our guest is William Longavisha. He's the international correspondent for Vanity Fair, and he traveled to Iraq to answer one of the many questions surrounding those killings. Why? His article, Rules of Engagement, appears in the November issue. You're invited to join the discussion. We're especially interested in speaking with those of you with a military background, if you have fought in Iraq, or if you have questions about the U.S. counterinsurgency strategy there. Give us a call. The number is 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Mr. Longavisha, before the break, we were talking about just the difficulties of the position that the military finds itself in, if you just pick up where you left off before the break.
It's very difficult to react to hostilities in Iraq for the U.S. military without inflicting casualties on non-combatants or innocent civilians, because we really cannot distinguish between our foes and neutrals. I wouldn't use the word friends, because we certainly don't have very many in places like Anbar anymore. But we can't make that distinction. Now we can. The alternative is simply to withdraw or something, not to fight. But that. At this point, is not an option for the Marines and soldiers on the ground. That's not their option. They have to respond, and they have to protect themselves very much. And in that process, whether trying to control an unruly city, whether responding directly to an attack, an ambush, a complex ambush, whether pursuing insurgents into a house, they lack the ability to make the fine distinctions necessary to keep from either insulting or killing the non-combatants. And you can look at the progression of this guerrilla war in Anbar, and in fact all through central Iraq, and measure it really by the killing of non-combatants and the insulting of particularly of men in front of their families.
Let's go to a caller in Providence, Rhode Island, and Mike.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I recently got back from Iraq about a month ago, and I've seen some pretty unpleasant things. And largely, it's on the American side. My concern is that, you know, troops are given plenty of defensive measures, armor, weaponry, this sort of thing, but not the reactive skills and tools that they need to respond to scenarios that present themselves. My concern is that, do you see this trend changing? Do you see our troops being given more leeway or more opportunity to defend themselves? What was your experience while you were there, sir?
I think that it's very difficult to give our troops the necessary tools to respond here. In other words, let's be realistic. The Marines or the U.S. Army is made up of people who don't speak Arabic, you know, who don't know who to trust. The point you're making about the negative side of force protection, I believe, is what you're really saying, is a legitimate point. But we can't ask people not to protect themselves. We can't ask our institutions not to provide that level of protection. We're sort of stymied. And I think what it boils down to is there is this huge disconnect from the streets of Iraq. I have noticed over the years, because I don't actually spend a lot of time with the military, mostly I'm outside of the bubbles and I'm on the streets, this strange thing which happens, which is that when an American patrol comes by, the streets change temporarily. And as soon as the patrol has passed, they return to their original condition. It's as if the Marines or the U.S. Army, the soldiers, had not passed through. It's like a wedge moving through water. And I think within the military, that's very difficult to understand because they are in the wedge. They, by definition, cannot know what it's like when they're not there. And again, you know, we run across these fundamental inabilities to grapple with the problems that present themselves in a guerrilla war like this.
Mike, are you still with us?
I am still here, yes.
Mike, may I ask, what was your job in Iraq? What was your mission?
My battalion and I, we performed convoy security throughout the nation. I've been to Anbar. I've been to Baghdad, downtown, Green Zone, these sort of places. And it's my experience with the rules of engagement that it's very very tentative, and at the platoon level especially, we see a fear of paperwork, we see a reluctance. And that's not to say that the soldiers aren't well-trained or given the tools they need. It seems a very bureaucratic issue that we don't want to wrong the Iraqis because, like you mentioned earlier, the good guys or the neutral guys look just like the bad guys, as it were.
Okay, Mike, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Longavish, I think it's important to go back to Haditha. And as you mentioned, appropriately so, this matter is under investigation. But what is it that's being investigated? Is it that the Marines used excessive force, that they used force against civilians without adequate justification, or that they created a false narrative of what happened there?
Well, the allegations are a little bit of all of that. The allegations, again, I am not the judge and jury here. The allegations are that they violated the rules of engagement. They shot people who didn't qualify as legitimate collateral casualties. That's the allegation. Basically, the allegation is of murder. And in war, there is murder in war. And, of course, we all know you can't, shoot prisoners. No one is claiming quite that they did that, although there was some killing around a car that was involved in the story that comes close to that. The question is, was this murder or was this legitimate? And legitimate according to the rules of engagement.
And is that their contention, is the contention of those involved that they were under fire and that they had to defend themselves?
I think there's really no doubt that they were under fire. I mean, I know that some people doubt that, but I, having looked at this carefully, I think they were under fire. They, first of all, they had taken a hit. The landmine had killed one of their men, wounded two others, and blown up a Humvee. And then it does appear very likely, although I'm not absolutely sure, but it does appear very likely that they came under fire, that the ambush expanded. This would be normal for Iraq. And there's no reason to believe that they did not come under fire. The question is, what was the level of response to that fire? And it gets very complicated in terms of this story. It's very difficult to do on the radio, but the questions play out around those details.
Why do you call your piece "Rules of Engagement"?
Because fundamentally, their defense What they say in their own defense, again, they have not yet been accused formally, is that they were operating within the rules of engagement, that they do not deny that 24 Iraqis died. They say this is very unfortunate, but this is the nature of war, and we were operating within the rules with the tools as we had been given, and you cannot prosecute us for this. This is not fair.
Let's go to a caller in Miami, Florida, and Frank. Hello, Frank? Frank, I am so sorry, but it sounds like you have something important to say, but we're not in a position to hear it. So let me see if I can paraphrase what it is I think you're trying to say, because I think what you're suggesting is that we don't have the stomach as Americans to apply the measures that really need to be taken to fight an insurgency. Mr. Longavich, I think that's what he's trying to say. So.
Oh, I see. Is that what he is trying to say?
That's what he's trying to say. I can hear him somewhat, but it's very hard for me to decipher. It's hard, so I'm going to have to let him go again.
Okay.
I think that's his...
That certainly is not what I am saying. In fact, it's not a question of our stomach. And the problem is that the more force we apply, the more enemies we create. So it's not a question of going in and kicking down more doors. And we have... Our soldiers are plenty brave. They've got plenty of stomach. This is a tough fight. And there's no question that we are applying force in Iraq, massive force. And the problem is really just almost you could call it a gaming problem. It doesn't work. It doesn't work.
You're tapping into an important debate that's going on here in Washington. And it's not, unlike most debates about the Iraq War, it's not strictly a partisan one. And the argument is that there are just not enough troops in Iraq to get the job done, that this is the fatal flaw, that this may have been a military initiative that was appropriate in its conception, but that it just isn't being well executed because there just isn't enough force on the ground. Given what you saw, does that make sense?
I know that very many smart people believe that, and I listen to them carefully. It does not correspond with my experience in Iraq. It is clear to me that we had more than enough troops to do the job against Saddam. We walked in there quite easily and defeated his army in traditional terms. But also, it has become clear to me since then, as the civil war and the guerrilla insurgency have grown, that if we double or triple the level of troops that we have in the country, we're not really going to be able to affect it. As I say, the troops move through, for the most part, in a wedge of steel, and Iraq closes in immediately behind them. If you double that or triple it, you're not going to see much of an effect. We went through this in Vietnam. In Vietnam, we started with whatever small number, a few thousand advisors, and then after Westmoreland came in and we were sitting at 200,000, then he wanted 300,000, then he wanted 400,000, then he wanted 500,000, and he got them, troops on the ground. Certainly this did prop up the government of Saigon, but it did not affect the outcome of the war. In other words, 500,000 times zero is still zero.
I think some Americans are having trouble, and of course it's true. You know, we're sitting over here in the safety and, you know, comfort and security of our homes, and you know, these young men, mostly men, are being asked to do a difficult job in our name. But I think it's very hard for many Americans to understand how it is that there is any justification for shooting children in the course of a war, which is one of the things that is alleged to have occurred in Haditha.
Well, I would like to avoid getting into pointing fingers from a moralistic point of view. The war always involves the killing of innocents. But let me rephrase what you've just said and point out another aspect of the Haditha story. That same day when these killings in question were committed on Route Chestnut in Haditha, a little farther south, another group of insurgents, or a group of insurgents, were discovered and went into a house. That house was then bombed. Now, the Americans didn't know who else was in the house. It's likely that the men who went into that house were indeed insurgents, but it was a residential house. It was bombed. It was destroyed, and everyone inside was destroyed. It was hit with a 500-pound bomb. There's never been any question about that. This is not being raised. So it may be difficult to believe that somehow to implicitly approve of the killing of women and children, et cetera. But our tactics in Iraq, this is a standard thing. I mean, let's just be truthful about it. This is what happens when you call in a bomb on a house. You don't know who's inside. You can't ask the question because if you try, you're going to get shot. You can't knock on the door. You can either walk away from it. You can maybe surround it and try to starve them out. But if you follow the rules of engagement that we have, you do call in air power. And air power is not – it may be very precise and on some sort of distant level. But up close, it's not precise at all. I mean, it just kills everybody inside, period.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to North Carolina and Chris.
Yes.
What's your question or comment? Hello.
Yes, this is Chris.
What's on your mind, Chris?
I'm sorry?
I said, what's on your mind? What's your comment or question?
Okay. Hi, I'm Chris Nelson from North Carolina. I was an Army reservist. I was the execution officer, executive officer of a transportation unit when the war first began. And we put, I was responsible for a fleet of 127 trucks that drove 3 million miles and put 10,000 tanks in the battlefield. And I've kind of come in on the middle of the conversation, but I just wanted to add something to you guys were speaking about a minute ago about how this, in a lot of ways, is still a Cold War force fighting against a paramilitary and non-conventional force. And and I just wanted to offer any comments I could there. And then you were talking about the women and children piece. And some of that relates back to the Cold War force that we do have. For example, the vehicles we had was designed to carry the Army's M1 Abrams tank. The M1 Abrams tank, when it's fully combat loaded, is 87,000 tons. The truck, the trailer, and the tank we were carrying into the battlefield from the seaport, you have 250,000 pounds at that point. When you come up on a human chain in southern Iraq at the beginning of the war, where they have dug a ditch across the road to get the kind-hearted Americans to stop their truck, and teenagers come over the berm with ice picks and jump up on your truck and ice pick your drivers through the window, you have to start making decisions that are hard. Mm-hmm. And I, as a reservist, if I could also comment and say,
Chris, I need you to be as brief as you can because we're running down to our last couple minutes here.
Sure. Mm-hmm. It's just that one of the things that I noticed, and I'll make this my final, is that reservists, remember, we were part-timers doing this. And the problem that I ran into is I had 17 and 18-year-old kids driving 600-mile convoys, and they would change zones, green zones, amber zones, red zones. And with that, the rules of engagement changed.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, when somebody in a BMW drove up dressed like a civilian, and when it's 170 degrees inside the truck and all you can hear is a diesel engine roaring, but you see a muzzle flash, mm-hmm. it poses a lot of problems. And I'll just leave it at that.
Chris, I thank you so much for your call.
You bet.
Mr. Longavisho, that was an important testimony from this man, and it sounds like that comports to what you saw. So I'd like to, we're down to our last minute here, and I'd like to ask if you can, it's a very important and complicated piece, ask you to summarize, it seems unfair, but I need to ask you. So you, just as a final question, you say that the video of Hadith, there is a video of some of the houses that were at issue here in this incident, and you say that this video should be required viewing, even training for soldiers going to Iraq. Why?
It shows the consequences of our rules of engagement when unintended casualties occur. It shows the tragedy, and more important, really, it shows the outrage. It shows the growth right before your eyes of the opposition and of the war itself. It shows and predicts the death in the future of other Americans.
William Longavisho, thank you so much. William Longavisho is the international correspondent for Vanity Fair. His article, Rules of Engagement, appears in the November issue. You can find a link to it at our website, npr.org/talk. When we come back from a short, and thank you, Mr. Longavisho, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your work. When we come back from a short break, an argument that it's time to stop the partisan finger-pointing and focus on what to do now in the war on terror, former head of counterterrorism Richard Clark joins us. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.